welcome to Turn the Page, the official podcast of the Syosset Public Library.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Turn the Page. I'm your host today, Jen, and I am joined by a fantastic author who is here with her adult debut. And I'm so excited to talk about this really, really fun mystery. And so let's say hello. Welcome to the show. Could I ask you your name and the name of your book, please?
Yeah. Hi, everyone. I'm Kristen Perrin, and I'm the author of How to Solve Your Own Murder.
This book is so much fun. I read it in two sittings, and it could have been one, but it was really late at night, so I had to
but that's what I like to hear.
Oh, I'm so glad. Yes, the pacing is just perfect. And so I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about your journey toward this book. I know you've written some others for different age groups, and I also know that you were a bookseller at one point, and as a former Borders gal myself, I'm very interested in how that may have played into your journey as well.
Oh yeah. I love chatting to fellow former booksellers. I love chatting to current booksellers. So yeah, that's absolutely my jam. Yeah, my publishing journey has been it's been a really interesting one. I have been writing for middle grade. It's one of these things that's a bit tricky to explain to people because people will search my books and see that they are not in English. They only sold in translation. But if you speak German, Polish, or Dutch and are interested in middle grade fantasy for 8 to 12 year olds, that had been kind of the way that I was quietly making a living for the last 4 or so years. And I'd always wanted to try to just kind of reinvent, what I was doing. And then we had a pandemic. And I'm sure this story is not new with a lot of authors, because I think with a lot of authors during that time, we either became hyper-productive and tried everything possible, or people just quieted down and kind of let themselves rest. And, both ways are very valid. I was the former, and I wanted to try on every possible new twist and turn and type of idea. What if I wrote this? What if I wrote that? And I ended up circling back to what I think was the heart of me as a reader and as a writer, which was just this classic cozy mystery setup. I guess it took off from there after that, and it's been a really exciting pivot.
Nice. That's a really interesting story about your children's publishing. I'm curious, in general, did the writing process change for you when you shifted from children to adult? And were there challenges or things that were easier that you didn't foresee? Was it like a different process for you?
That's a really great question. I think there are some things that are fundamentally the same when you write. As a writer, you have things that just fit for you. For me, I think I love the experimental side of things. I love to discover ideas on the page. I do outline things, but when I went from children's into this, my outlines stick a lot better in the children's. The arc of the story, the emotional journeys of the characters. It's possible that that's because I came from children's literature as a bookseller and have just so much experience selling children's books, talking about children's books. It really was sort of like my oxygen for a lot of years. So when I shifted into mystery for adults, I tried to start it the way that I normally did with my children's books. I had an outline, and I allowed myself to veer off, kilter where I felt like I wanted to. But I found that it was a lot trickier to keep track of everything if I let myself do that. I definitely had a lot of crashing around and trying to figure out how to do it. And so as a result, I wrote this book 3 separate times. I had an initial draft that I wrote 90,000 words of. I got feedback from my agent. She was really encouraging. She gave me a lot of notes. And I think rather than try to pull it apart, I just started again. I just went back to page one and I same characters, same town, same premise, but 90,000 new words. And the whole story kind of cracked wide open when I just let myself say, okay, that was one way of telling it. Let's try it again and see if it kind of cracks it open in a way that feels much more right. And luckily for me, that worked. I don't want to have to do that with every book now. So I'm hoping that that learning curve has been, accomplished now.
Wow, that's like real dedication. And I know that like drafting is always part of it, but it's really interesting to kind of go in with that, I don't know, that expectation of like we're just going to tell it in a new way. And it's almost like in a playful way almost. I think it's keeping it playful part of keeping it fun, because once it starts to feel like, for me anyway, once it starts to feel like work, that's when I think that dedication gets a little harder,
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the things that I because I have, I'm in deep to book two now. I've got that it's written, but who knows how my process is gonna, it's early days, so I don't want to like jinx it or talk too much about it. But that first draft and the rewrites of that, I had a lot of freedom and pressure just wasn't there that I do have now because I have contracts in place, which is wonderful. It's a great problem to have. But the first rewrites of it, I was able to just write it from this really just free place of because it was still very experimental. It was still, what if I did this? Who knows? Maybe it won't work. And yeah, I don't have quite that amount of kind of joyful freedom with it quite so much anymore. But I've worked hard to find ways to tap back into that, without it seeming a bit too forced. And I think ultimately, I just come back to the love of the genre and thinking about and reading a lot and thinking about and consuming other media and just kind of remembering that this is something that not only do I like to write, but I like to consume. So that can help.
Nice. So let's talk a little bit about genre actually before we get into the characters, because this is in some ways like a cozy mystery. And what always impresses me about cozy mystery when it's done well, as it is here, is that like the pacing is always really impressive because it's cozy. So it's more of like a stroll than it is like a breakneck, power walk, let's say. And but you still have to sort of keep the reader strung along with little bits of information and how you trickle it. So, like, how do you approach pacing in a cozy mystery, and how do you balance that slow burn with like that, that sense of urgency that you need to keep investigating,
That's a really good one. And I like this question particularly because pacing is really important in cozy mystery in a way that's very different from thriller or kind of the like psychological domestic suspense, I guess it's called, and other things that fall under the crime genre but function a lot differently on the page. The pacing for cozy mystery is like it's something that I think you want to balance it, or at least I try to balance it with a sense of place, a sense of people, and a sense of just, I guess, questions, just those sort of things gently interacting on the page, I think can help like the pages turn in a way that is, you're not going to be racing through them the way that you will heart pounding like a thriller, just simply because that's not the game here, and yeah, it's an interesting one as well because I'm finding that co the pacing of cozy mystery isn't for everyone. There is this like, let's get to know a village, let's get to know, people's pasts, but let's do it in a way that is just kind of a, who are these guys? Rather than, yeah. So I think for me, a lot of the delving in and out of that, a lot of stuff does get cut and tightened up. I mean, I actually do tend to have to add. So my first drafts are a bit thin. And I have to build on them. And usually what I have to stop and add are things like the cozy details. But I find that once the plot is locked in place and the characters are interacting, that kind of sheen, that extra polish of coziness, is a joy to kind of go and sprinkle through.
Nice. That's a perfect answer because it literally segues to my next observation, which is that something that I love about like particularly like small town mysteries is that like there always does feel like there's almost like an anthropological angle to it, you know, where you're getting to know like a closed community and all of its members and their dynamic and how they interact. And yeah, I would love if you could talk a little bit about like how you crafted Castle Knoll and like you know, how you populate a town like this. I imagine that's like a lot of what has to go into like your multiple drafts too, because once you add all these actors, you have to think about like keeping all those plates spinning. Yeah. So can you talk about like, yeah, this like the setting and how that, yeah, like how that all come together.
Of course, yeah. So with Castle Knoll, there's a lot that I can say about the from different angles on this question. Castle Knoll, from like a geographical point of view, so obviously I'm not English, but I do live in the UK and I have been here for 17 years. I'm not gonna say like I'm, you know, the expert in UK village life. But I think that the way that I approach it, not being an English person, gives me this almost like sort of like literary tourism aspect of the things that I appreciate about the UK and the things that I notice about the UK might not be the things that the average English person pays attention to, because to me they're novelties, even now after, you know, 17 years of living here. And so Castle Knoll in particular is based on a real town in Dorset called Corfe Castle. It is just this. It's a perfect little village that has, you know, a castle ruin down on, you know, on a hill on one end. It has a steam train that goes to the beach to the next town over. It has all of these little, just the charming little shops. And so I thought, you know, what better than to take a place that, and my husband is also from that area. So I visited a lot and I know it a lot. And so I thought, you know, I can have this authenticity. Obviously, I'm gonna rename and tweak a few things because I don't want to try to be like telling that town story accurately. It's just not gonna, it was too daunting for me to try and say, you know, let's use a real town. And then I started thinking about, you know, I have my premise of my murder, which I should have said right at the beginning. It's, you know, a woman in 1965 is told by a fortune teller that one day she's going to be murdered, only for, you know, one of her best friends to go missing instead. And a whole bunch of sets of dominoes kind of fall over to get her more and more convinced as the years go on that this is actually really going to come true, until she's an old woman and she is utterly, absolutely convinced to such a degree that she's compiled files and files of everyone's secrets in the town to try to root out who would be her eventual murderer. And those files were a really great kind of like organic way for me to build the town, because you think, well, if you have a paranoid woman who spent her whole life being afraid of a lot of the people that she's coming across in her normal life, who are they and what kind of secrets do they all have? And so yeah, I kind of think about the files or the town almost as like a snow globe. You know, we have this village and you just shake it up and all of the pieces are gonna fall in different ways, depending on how vigorously you shake it, how often you shake it, and you know what's colliding in there. And once you kind of start getting one person down, then another person kind of grows out of that, and other people, you know, you really, I don't know. I think it's almost like, it's really hard to explain, because I think it's just thinking about people. This anthropological angle that you mentioned is absolutely accurate. I think that's a wonderful way of thinking about it, because it is just, what if you start with one person? Well, who are the other people that know them? Then who might have wronged them? Who might they like? Who might they love? Who might have broken their heart? You know, who you know, who do they hate? Why do they hate them? And then suddenly you've built an entire town.
That is so cool. I really love that perspective on it. And when you think of it, because I do want to finally turn to Annie because I love her. Like she has to be all at once, like not just like a, you know, an amateur investigator, but also, as you say, an anthropologist and a historian, and like all these other hats that she has to wear while she's trying to figure this out. So let's get to her. Could you tell us a little bit about Annie Adams, why she finds herself at her late great aunt's estate? And like where we, you know, yeah, what's going on in this cozy mystery? I feel like I kind of buried the lead a little bit by waiting this long, but.
Oh no, that's okay. Well, that's good for pacing, right? You know, people are gonna have to, you know, get, you know, halfway through to be like, yes, ah. So Annie Adams is 25 years old, and she lives in a sort of rundown but massive ha townhouse in Chelsea, in London, with her bohemian artist painter mother. She finds out that this house is not actually owned by her mom. It's owned by this estranged relative who is her great aunt Frances, who is our, you know, paranoid woman who had had her fortune told and lives in the village of Castleknoll, 2.5 hours away. Never comes to London, has never met Annie, has never met Annie's mom, just lets them live in this house for, you know, reasons that are relevant to the plot, that I won't spoil. Annie gets summoned because of something that's in this fortune. So the book is structured around the words of the fortune that Frances received when she was 16. And one of those it's not a fortune that's told in astrology or in tarot. I didn't want to pick a regular way of telling fortunes because I thought, I don't know if I can make that, you know, accurate. It's a real deep dive. There's a lot of people who are experts in things like, you know, tarot or astrology, and I respect that, and I'm not an expert in any of those. So it's more like an abstract, cryptic kind of fortune. And we have this line, find the right daughter and keep her close. And something happens that convinces Frances that Annie is the right daughter. And she sends a letter through her lawyers to Annie, summoning her to a meeting in Castle Knoll. And Annie is, you know, unemployed, slightly unsure about where her life is going. She wants to be a murder mystery writer. She's kind of failing at it. So she's like, you know what? Why not? This is weird. Let's figure this out. Let's dig into my family history. What is, you know, what hasn't my mom told me about all of this, you know, that's in my family's past? So she heads to Castle Knoll, and when she gets there, her great aunt Frances has been murdered. Her future has finally come true. And Annie, it turns out, is now a part of an inheritance competition that Frances set up. Because she was really tired of not being believed by her skeptical friends and family and everyone in the village, that she was like, you know what? You're gonna believe me now because whoever solves my murder is going to inherit all of this money in this massive estate. So, yeah, I didn't really tell you much about Annie and her personality in that, but it was important for me to have, because we've got two voices in this book. One is Frances's diaries in 1965, and the other is Annie in present day. And Annie is our, you know, kind of, I wanted her to be someone who wasn't entirely successful at what she was aiming for in life, has that sort of early 20s sense of adriftness that happens, you know, when you come from a place that's kind of privileged, which is, you know, she may live in a ramshackle, you know, townhouse, but it's like a Manhattan brownstone. It's prime real estate. And yeah, so I think it, you know, I wanted her to have a reason to kind of crash around, make some mistakes, but learn a bit about herself in the process, and then ultimately see if she can outsmart, you know, everyone around her.
I really like her, and for me, it's because, and I mean this in a super loving way, like golden retriever energy, you know, like super enthusiastic, but maybe like a little clumsy, you know.
Yes, I love this. I've been this is so this is slightly veering off topic, but I've been rewatching the show Twin Peaks, because I'm from Washington State. My bio says Seattle, but I'm actually from a town called Issaquah in Washington State, which is pretty much the next town over from where Twin Peaks was filmed. And so sometimes I rewatch it because it's like the background to my childhood. But I, in this most recent rewatch, did not realize how influenced I was by that show in particular. And the Agent Cooper in that show has strong golden retriever energy and is brought, he comes to this small town, is just absolutely charmed by like all these things that he sees. And the locals are just like, why do you care so much about this random one cup of coffee? And I think with Annie, I inadvertently, like, unintentionally brought a bit of that forward. She's definitely someone who I didn't want her to be like the cynical Londoner coming to the countryside to just like hate on everything and then be won over that way. I do love that trope and I love those people. But she just came out on the page as someone who was a bit more optimistic. And I kind of thought if you're someone who wants to be a murder mystery writer and you find yourself in the middle of a murder mystery, you're probably not going to be, mad about it. If it was someone you didn't know, if it was someone that you're not, really like sad about, I think, yeah, you'd be intrigued. You'd be like, wow, okay, let's see what I can do with this.
Yeah, I love that energy. And it does great things for plot too, because she's very willing to put herself into slightly dangerous situations. And because she's so earnest, I think that's really like part of the part of the golden retriever I'm hanging on to, just that like earnest like investment. Like you're really invested in her too and her success. And I think it's just like it's a really nice spin on like a protagonist in this type of story that I really enjoyed. You did mention before that you are writing a sequel, and I know that like it's hard to talk about those things while they're still in the works. But could you tell us a little bit about what we can expect going forward? Are we going to stay in Castle Knoll or are we going other places? Or what can you say at this point?
Let's see. Well, it's early days. I've got to go through the editorial process, and I love I mean, it's really funny because as I think it's probably pretty clear that like I love ed I'm weird. I love edits. Edits are my jam. I find this act of making a book into the best book it can be to be a really energizing process. So knowing how much my drafts can potentially change, I'll tiptoe around it a bit. But one of the things I wanted to do was I wanted to stay true to form. So in and it's not spoiling anything if I say that Francis's writings and Francis's voice, there's enough material in her, house and her, world and her files, to keep her voice on the page. And that was very important to me, that the format remain the same. It won't be exactly the same in the sense that like it's there's some tricky things. I set myself up a real challenge. One of them is that if we have diaries from a character that are slotting like a puzzle piece into a present day investigation, the pace at which the main character in the present time gets the information from the past has to be very carefully handled. They either can get all the information at once and not know what to do with it until they learn a certain amount of things, which is part of what I try to do, or they can get the information piece by piece and digest it and come to their conclusions and have it build. And that's, I think, the track the way that I took the first book. The second book, I'm trying to play with it, in multiple ways, and it could change. That's the thing. It could be, oh, well, maybe we learn, I don't know, some past about someone else that, let me think of a way to not spoil too much. There are characters in the second book that I've made some very bold choices with at this point. There are characters that we've met in the first book. And they have pasts that I had a lot of fun with. They were people I wanted to spend more time with, and I think I think right now my early drafts, that's what I was aiming for. I think the things I can say that probably won't change. I don't know if they do, then maybe it'll come back in future books. But I definitely felt like Jenny had to come visit. Jenny, her best friend. I was like, I think we need to have definitely more of the two of them hanging out together in Castle Knoll. So yeah, we're in Castle Knoll. That was a very rambling way of answering your question. I'm
No,
sorry.
I love it.
I think because I get really twitchy about the second book because I don't want to jinx it because I've just written it and I'm like, you know, when you first write a draft and it's the first draft, at least for me, I come off of it with this euphoric sense of just like love for like this piece of work. And that will wear off very quickly once I start editing it. And I will be like, what is this garbage? And that's a normal part of the process. That's a normal phase, I think. And I know other writers that feel this way too. And then you learn to fall back in love with it as you polish it up, as you change it, as you work with it. So yeah, that I think that's my reasoning for that rambling answer.
That's great. And that is a really great answer because some people say, I can't say anything. And I'm like, that's valid. Thank you for even saying that. That's great. But I really like the way that you talk about your process and like ways that things could have gone. And, you know, like I think it's very valuable stuff for other up and coming writers. So, you know, thank you for sharing your process and for sharing this book. And, you know, if you ever want to come back and talk about that second one, I'd
Oh,
be very happy for that.
yes. Well, this has been really wonderful, and I'm so like thank you for having me. And I think when the second book makes its appearance, I would love to come back and chat about it because I can't wait for people to just spend more time in Castle Knoll.
Excellent. All right. Well, we will see you then soon. And in the meantime, listeners, readers, you are going to go check out How to Solve Your Own Murder. By the time that you hear this, it will be out in the world. So you can go check it out at your favorite library or independent bookstore, wherever you like to go for books. Thanks so much for joining us. It is now time to close this chapter.
It's time to close this chapter of Turn the Page. Join us for the next episode.